The headlines. The Yemeni army says it has successfully targeted Abha Airport in southwestern Saudi Arabia. Iran's President Raisi says the Biden administration's policies do not differ from those of the Trump administration. And Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Western threats and ultimatums would do nothing to ease tensions over Ukraine. Hello, welcome. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Yemeni army says it has successfully targeted Abha Airport in Saudi Arabia's southwestern region of Asir. The army spokesman Yahya Sari says that the Qassem K2 drones were used in the operation, which has reportedly disrupted flights at the airport. Sari noted that the Saudi-led coalition has been using the airport for launching airstrikes against Yemen. The coalition's warplanes have bombed different regions across Yemen, including the capital Sana'a, over the past day. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a war against the kingdom's southern neighbor in 2015 with the aim of reinstating a friendly regime there. The U.S. has been assisting the coalition with munitions and intelligence support. The war has brought about a severe humanitarian crisis in Yemen, pushing millions of people on the verge of starvation. Just hours ago, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi met with dozens of foreign ambassadors in Tehran on the occasion of the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. During his speech at the event, the president drew an analogy between the current and the former U.S. administrations. He said the Biden administration is no different from his predecessor in his policies and actions. The president also talked about Iran's 2015 deal, saying the status quo is the result of Washington's withdrawal and the inaction of other signatories. President Raisi said diplomacy only works when all sides abide by their commitments, and pointing out to the ongoing Vienna talks, he said that any negotiations should guarantee Iran's national interests.
Talks are resumed in Vienna to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. This is the eighth round of such talks in the Austrian capital. The U.S. has so far failed to remove its maximum pressure sanctions, which it imposed on Iran after the former pulled out of the JCPOA, and give guarantees that a future administration will not ditch the deal again. Now Iran's top security chief said that there is no coherence coming from the U.S. on the revival of the 2015 Iran deal. Ali Shamkhani has stressed that the U.S. administration cannot impose the cost of its internal disputes on Iran.
And I think that now what we are witnessing is a division internally in the United States in the political establishment, both Democrats and Republicans, regarding a resolution to the ongoing situation with Iran regarding whether to go back to the table and to rejoin the JCPOA. We know that Biden has made overtures, and the State Department has said that they would grant some concessions in the forms of sanctions waivers. But like many Iranian commentators and politicians and diplomats have said, it doesn't go far enough.
Voices from the U.S. government show that there is no coherence in the country to make political decisions in the direction of advancements in the Vienna talks. The U.S. administration cannot pay for its internal disputes by violating Iran's legal rights. And voice from Iran and the P4+1 group of countries, Britain, France, Russia, and China plus Germany, have been holding negotiations in the Austrian capital for 10 months in a bid to resurrect the JCPOA.
And I think that there's not much appetite for a deal with Iran at this point. I think the Trump administration did tremendous damage to the JCPOA by removing itself from it.
The Vienna revival talks are now focused on the guarantees that Iran is looking for, which include the verification of any sanctions removal measures. Iran also wants to be assured that sanctions will not be brought back under new names or pretexts. But most importantly, it is seeking assurances that the next U.S. administration will adhere to the deal, something which the U.S. Special Envoy, Rob Malley, has said that Washington cannot guarantee, and hence bringing the fate of the deal into question.
The new round of talks comes amid rising hawkish voices in the U.S. A group of 33 U.S. Republican senators, led by Senator Ted Cruz, wrote a letter to President Biden warning him that any deal with Iran on restoring the JCPOA requires Senate approval. The senators warned Biden that they will do everything in their power to block a possible deal if he moves forward without them. They also said that the implementation of any agreement will be severely, if not terminally, hampered if the Biden administration does not fulfill a range of obligations in relation to congressional oversight over any agreements. The Republican senators said that if there is a deal that does not have Senate approval, it would be subject to being reversed as soon as there is a new president.
We see that the United States has been belligerent and has continued to put what it calls a maximum pressure campaign on the Iranian people, on the Iranian state, on the legal and legitimate Iranian government. And we see it as a web of coordinated activities by which we also know that Israel and the Zionist lobby are also pushing very heavily in the United States, in Washington.
The former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally left the JCPOA in May 2018 and reimposed the anti-Iran sanctions that the deal had lifted. He also placed additional sanctions on Iran under other pretexts not related to the nuclear case as part of his maximum pressure campaign. The pressure campaign was led by the Israeli and Arab lobby groups in the U.S. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it is willing to compensate for Trump's mistake and rejoin the deal, but it has retained the sanctions as leverage.
So I think that the internal divisions in the United States politically will continue to give free rein to the national security state in the United States to continue to put maximum pressure on Iran. But we know very well that Iran is a sovereign country and it will defend itself.
Iranian officials have repeatedly stressed that the onus falls on the U.S. to remove all illegal sanctions against the Islamic Republic in a verifiable manner and guarantee that a new U.S. administration would not breach the JCPOA again.
Our correspondent Homolesky joined us earlier from Vienna with more details on the resumption 8th round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories of the 2015 deal.
So this morning, there was yet another meeting between the head of Iran's delegation, Mr. Baghdadi, and EU coordinator Enrique Mora. And right now, we just got the news that Mr. Baghdadi is in a bilateral meeting with his Russian counterpart, Mikhail Ulyanov, taking place right now. And of course, these meetings have been going on since the 8th round resumed on Tuesday between Iran and the remaining signatories of the JCPOA. Of course, we know that the U.S. team, led by Special Representative Rob Malley, is also here, indirectly involved in the talks. The Russian ambassador tweeted saying that he's been talking with Mr. Malley as well on finding ways to keep things moving. And just yesterday, as we said, Mr. Ulyanov said that in his meeting with the EU coordinator, they'd tried to find, in his words, creative means or ways to resolve the outstanding remaining issues. What are they? What we're hearing is, and the most important issue is guarantees. And this is what some have been calling, some experts have been calling, inherent guarantees of any kind of agreement. If we look at any agreement that's being signed between various parties, what guarantees are going to be in it that will make it costly for any of the sides to violate it, to withdraw from it, as happened under the Trump administration? Why Iran is insisting on these guarantees, of course, because of its past experience.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has released a new video of a long-range ballistic missile unveiled on Wednesday. The missile, dubbed Kheba Shekan, is capable of hitting targets within a range of 1,450 kilometers with pinpoint accuracy. It can also penetrate missile shields with high maneuverability. The projectile is classified as the third generation of long-range missiles developed by the IRGC. In recent years, Iran has made great advances in its missile program, which it says is entirely defensive. The latest missile test comes as the country marks the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Israeli settlers storm Islamic holy sites at a Palestinian village in the northwest of the occupied West Bank. Settlers under army protection broke into four Palestinian shrines in Kfar Haris and vandalized a number of vehicles. Israeli settlers regularly attack Palestinian homes, shops, and holy shrines in the occupied West Bank with impunity. Human rights groups accuse Israel of using settler violence to force Palestinians to leave their homes as part of its land grab policy. Some 700,000 Israeli settlers live in the occupied West Bank. Under international law, all Israeli settlements in the occupied territories are deemed illegal. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Western threats and ultimatums would do nothing to ease tensions over Ukraine. In a meeting with his British counterpart in Moscow, Lavrov said that Moscow is in favor of diplomacy. He also downplayed the Western anxieties over Russian military drills in Belarus. In the meantime, NATO has issued a statement saying that if Russia chooses non-diplomatic approaches, it would face economic sanctions and an increasing military presence by the alliance in Eastern Europe. These exchanges follow simultaneous 10-day military drills by Ukraine and Russia. Ukraine says Russia's joint drills with Belarus are meant for psychological pressure and that Washington is calling them an escalatory action. The West has been alleging for some time that Russia is preparing to invade Ukraine. But the Kremlin denies this, saying instead that NATO should stop its eastward enlargement.
In recent days, a series of separate delegations from the EU have traveled to the United States, Ukraine, and Russia as tensions between the West and Moscow show no sign of abating. The Kremlin insists the security of Russian citizens is paramount, and therefore Ukraine cannot be allowed to join NATO. On Monday, the head of the 30-nation alliance confirmed additional NATO forces have been moved to Eastern Europe, and there's a plan to make that permanent.
There is a process now going on within NATO, also, of course, in close consultation with our military commanders, to adjust our presence in the eastern part of the alliance.
Peace activists claim NATO is being unnecessarily provocative.
We would have a lot of advantages only with one symbolical sentence, not to expand with Ukraine and Georgia. And then Putin would be satisfied and you can make agreements with him.
The EU is sending huge amounts of money to Kiev.
More than 17 billion euros.
Even though the bloc's own agencies say Ukraine is corrupt at the highest levels, EU citizens are worried the situation could exacerbate the bloc's energy crisis, given that we import so much from Russia.
Putting in danger European gas supplies. So this is really frightening to me personally. And I think the whole European population should be frightened about this.
That could be a solution for the energy crisis. Everybody just spend less money on army and more money on compensation kind of energy support for the people.
A number of political commentators say some senior figures in the EU and NATO believe the West is pushing Russia a bit too far. Double standards and hypocrisy are at play, according to impartial foreign policy analysts. They remind us the United States has approximately 800 military bases in 80 nations around the world. This as Russia is vilified for moving troops within its own borders. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The European Commission says the Eurozone's economy will grow less than expected in 2022 as surging inflation hampers recovery from the COVID pandemic. The EU executive says the bloc's gross domestic product will grow by 4% this year instead of the 4.3% forecast of only 3 months ago. Inflation is also set to increase to a much higher level than previously expected. The bloc experienced an economic boom in much of 2021 as the pandemic's toll started to wear off. The EU's economy commissioner says the growth has been hampered due to staff shortages, supply chain issues, and soaring energy prices. Further rise in inflation is also feared as a possible conflict between Moscow and the West over Ukraine could slash energy supply from Russia to Europe. Russia provides more than 40% of the bloc's natural gas. Iran's Islamic Revolution is being recalled globally by those who were of age to witness its immediate impact and for others who continue to feel its international legacy. Mina Taylor has more from London.
The revolution that continues to reverberate around the globe. Iran's Islamic Revolution ushering in a new age by ousting the US-backed Pahlavi regime. Father Frank Gelli, who became an ordained minister, recalls his initial reaction when news of the revolution broke.
At the time, I considered myself quite left-wing, so I enjoyed the idea there should be a revolution against the Shah. I consider the Shah a tyrant.
One of the most inspirational things about the Islamic Revolution for its many admirers is not just the impact that it's had inside of Iran, but it's the growing legacy that it continues to build globally. For political observers, Iran's stoic path proved an innovative and bold new model where alliances could be forged and solidarity fostered.
Because of its anti-imperialistic values, that's why Iran has good relations with lots of other countries around the world, Muslim and non-Muslim, that have also accepted colonialism an occupation. I mean, it could be Cuba, it could be Venezuela, many countries in Africa, around the world, who, you know, have a certain affinity with Iran because of that.
There's also another element to those who admire the aims and accomplishments of the revolution.
The Iranian revolution, as I mentioned, it tells us how you don't have to have only one model of political system, whereby, I mean, here in this country, we have a monarch who is head of a national church, but it's a farce. In reality, God has been pushed out of a public sphere, and so the whole thing is a charade. In Iran, there is a valuable presence of faith in the public sphere.
As the revolution moves towards another remarkable milestone, the West still continues its opposition campaign despite a lack of success.
I can't think of too many examples of countries around the world that have withstood the barrage of war, sanctions, media hatred, internal subterfuge, you know, kind of instigated from outside, that Iran has. Yet they're still here. And they're not just surviving by the skin of their teeth. They're thriving as well. They have a strong military. They have strong regional allies. They have political influence, especially within their area in the Middle East. I think that it's widely recognized, even by haters of Iran, that Iran is one of the major regional players.
With its legacy still rippling across the globe, supporters of the Islamic Revolution internationally know they owe Iran and Iranians a great debt. Amina Taylor, London.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Epic. Epic. Glory. Glory. Honor. Honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Islamic Revolution's capacities for building new Islamic civilization. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are in the 10 days done, the period marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The great leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, pursued loftier and vaster ideals than foundation of an Islamic establishment. His ideal, which has been also insisted upon and pursued by his successor, Ayatollah Khamenei, is the creation of the new Islamic civilization. Ayatollah Khamenei says in this regard, "The great and important message of our revolution for the Islamic Ummah and Muslim communities and nations is the revival of the Islamic identity, return to Islam, awakening of Muslims, and return to the Islamic uprising. This is the great message of our revolution to the Muslim nations, which Imam Khomeini was the great leader of this path and the great teacher of this course and school." Many thinkers have spoken on the features of civilization. French researcher Paul Roberts believes that civilization is a set of social phenomena including religious, ethical, scientific, technical, aesthetic, and artistic phenomena which grow and improve in a great community. However, civilization derives from civil and city. Verbally, it means civil life versus barbaric and primitive life, which is devoid of law and order. But what is the new Islamic civilization as one of the goals and ideals of the Islamic Revolution? The new Islamic civilization is seeking a society in which the individual will grow in both material and spiritual dimensions. He or she will enjoy a happy and dignified life while having the power, free will, and innovation to build the world. This civilization will be based on the principles of the Quran and the Islamic instructions. It intends to make humans happy in every time and place. In view of Imam Khomeini and Ayatollah Khamenei, the Islamic civilization refers to a historic and substantive reality that occurred during the time of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and spread afterwards. With the start of the prophethood of the Prophet and spread of the light of Islam, a new image of civilization was demonstrated with unique features. It was originated in the Arabian Peninsula, a land with little, if any, manifestation of civilization in that dark era in the world. At that time, the famous civilizations of Iran, Rome, and Greece were in decline. Inspired with the teachings of Islam, Muslims founded a civilization which created developments in thoughts, beliefs, sciences, arts, industries, politics, social relations, economy, culture, and military security affairs. This civilization took good features of other civilizations and added a lot to the human heritage. Creation of open cultural atmosphere, spread of ethical order and discipline, rule of spirituality, importance of thought as a principle, increase of welfare and living standards, refraining from ethnic and tribal prejudices, superiority of altruism and solidarity over egotism, development and promotion of knowledge and etiquette, serious care for the poor and the needy were the outstanding features of the Islamic civilization during the first centuries of the emergence of Islam. The Islamic civilization never restricted itself to a specific ethnicity or race. Therefore, Arabs, Iranians, Turks, Indians, Chinese, Mongols, Africans, and Romans had a share in the thriving of this civilization and considered it their own. Moreover, this civilization deemed a very lofty status for knowledge thanks to the insistence and encouragement of the Noble Quran, the Prophet of Islam, and his infallible successors on the issue. Historian George Sarton says, "The achievement of this magnitude of care for knowledge was that Muslims took over the scientific leadership in the world. From the second half of the 2nd century AH till 5th century AH, that is, for 350 years, they were the sole leader of knowledge. During the following 250 years, too, they were the pioneers of knowledge in the world alongside Christians. Promotion of ethics among Muslims was another feature of the Islamic civilization, which brought about forbearance and tolerance towards brothers in faith. Specialists of civilization maintain that ethics are among the basic principles of the Islamic civilization." One of the goals of the Islamic Revolution for building of the Islamic civilization is to set the ground in which Muslims minimize differences and maximize factors of unity and brotherhood. The recommendations of Ayatollah Khamenei on unity and bolstering common points among Muslims can be evaluated in the same category. Revival of the Islamic civilization does not mean to return to the past. It rather means to benefit from the assets of the past civilization in the modern world, and the Islamic Revolution can play the key role in this regard due to its numerous capacities. The new Islamic civilization tells us that religion is not in contrast with development and advancement. On the contrary, through seeking of justice and equality, it can bring about economic, social, and political development for everyone. It maintains that deep class gaps and the rule of rebels, godless governments, should be ended, and justice should be the basis for every action. There is no place for the anti-human Western culture and civilization in the Islamic civilization.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Let It Fall, LA 1982 to 1992, directed by John Ridley. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Suresh Grover, who is the director of the Monitoring Group, which is a leading anti-racist charity here in the UK that promotes civil rights. Now, Let It Fall provides an in-depth look at the racial tensions in Los Angeles in the 10 years leading up to the 92 riots, which erupted after the acquittal of four police officers charged in the brutal beating of Rodney King. The riots caused a lot of destruction in the streets of LA, which resulted in the deaths of more than 50 people, who were mostly black, injured over 2,000, and caused at least $1 billion worth of damages.
The Los Angeles police officially reprimanded Police Chief Darryl Gates.
We were having deaths from the chokehold.
He didn't get along with the community.
In the early 80s, the street gangs started to connect with the drug dealers.
It just got out of control.
Karen Tashima was killed in gang crossfire.
This is something that you always see on the news, and this time it happened to us.
We are determined to take back the streets of Los Angeles.
Operation Hammer was a free ticket to go out there and do overly aggressive police work.
What I witnessed at the scene was 100% LAPD policy.
Soon Ja Do, found guilty of killing a 16-year-old girl, received no jail time.
She got away with murder.
Black and brown people are being beat up, shot, choked to death by police forces all over this country.
We, the jury, find the defendant not guilty.
Not? You just disrespect us like this? Like our lives don't matter?
Not guilty, the verdict for all of them.
We were sort of stunned.
We need to back out of here before we have to use deadly force.
It's like pouring gasoline and striking a match. It's not protest anymore. Now it's a full-blown riot.
I was a part of a movement, a black movement. There's a Florence and Normandy in every city and every state.
It was just one of those days compassion wasn't handed out to other races.
God told me to go save him, save that man's life.
You talked about guerrilla warfare, and it's right here.
18-year-old Edward Song Lee was shot to death.
It doesn't seem real. I felt like it couldn't be happening to us.
I know the anger, and I know exactly what my people are feeling.
We've lost the city. It's gone.
I want to know why God let this happen.
Unity. Empowerment. They're not just cliches. We have to get ourselves together.
Thank you very much for coming on the show. Very much welcome here. And when you watch this documentary, you feel an overwhelming sense of injustice against black people in the US. And another thing that's striking about this documentary is that it's an oral history as told through many different perspectives and angles, through police officers, jurors, and a whole host of others, the victims and families of the victims. And Lee, if I can start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
I think you've sort of identified what makes it unique and what makes it particularly probing is it's an inside story. So the filmmakers, they don't go to pundits and people from the outside. Every single person you hear from was within the story. They're part of the story, whether they're perpetrators or victims or police or, you know, lost loved ones. And that and keeping to that very tight focus, I think, really, I mean, it obviously ups the emotional side of the stories because people are talking about their direct personal involvement, but it gives you that unique perspective because we're not trying to hear from, you know, professors and cultural critics outside it. We stay very much within the story, and I think that's a really great move. The other thing that's great is he doesn't identify who's who. So you start hearing from people, you might then find that they were a policeman who was, you know, inflicted some violence, or, you know, an African American who was involved in, you know, hurting a white American. And by doing that and saving the sort of the revelation, you get to just hear who these people are before you, otherwise you might just immediately identify them as, oh, racist police officer, mm-hmm. or, you know, violent African-American. And of course, what you're hearing is a more sort of multifaceted side to each of these stories, and I think that's a real strength in the film.
That is indeed a great strength, and you hear their personal stories, and I enjoyed that progression, and you feel a connection to all these characters. And Suresh, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Let It Fall?
I think it's a rich history, almost a forensic examination of a decade before the so-called uprisings. I wouldn't call it a riot. I use the word uprising, and there's a reason for it. And I think it tries to focus on what took place, what incidents took place, which led to the build-up of the riots, which is very important. The context is very, very important. And even in this country, when there are public disturbances taking place, people only look at one trigger moment mm-hmm. that started the stuff, rather than the history of relationship between the black communities and the police, for example.
So you're saying this context, this build-up is very important.
The context is absolutely critical. I mean, you know, the police commissioner's views about baton charges, metal baton charges, choke holes, and he tries to describe black people not suffering as much as the white people in terms of that. It's just sheer racism, in my view. It unmasks the real relationship between the authorities mm-hmm. and people who live in the area, who took part in it and who survived in it.
Of course, LA was a very iconic city, still is, but particularly at that time because of the Olympics, and they even had their first black mayor. So who would know, and underneath the surface, that all this racial tensions was bubbling?
Well, I think what he's trying to point out is that it's unmasked, but actually people who live in it know exactly what's happening, including the police office and the mayor and the police commissioner. So although the story in cinematic terms is being told through different eyes, mm. what is clear is that the bubble and the bubbling and the simmering and of dissent and the relationship souring between different authorities is actually very, very open and pertinent. Mm. And people are turning a blind eye to it. For example, you know, the chokehold is being criticized by everyone. It's actually made illegal. So what do the police do? Instead of decreasing their powers, they increase their powers by using a metal baton. And they use both taser and, I mean, you.
And I'll have to pause you there. We'll go into that detail later on.
One of the many issues that came up during his time as the chief was the chokehold. It was a controversy for a long, long time in the media.
The Los Angeles Police Commission late today officially reprimanded Police Chief Darrell Gates for comments he made last month about black people and a police restraint method.
Chief Gates said, in some blacks, when it is applied, the veins or arteries do not open up as fast as they do in normal people.
That's asinine. That's insanity. That I still to this day can't believe someone said that. And, of course, that raised a firestorm.
There is a direct parallel between the disproportionate killing of black people in this city and the irresponsible remarks of the chief of police.
That was truly shocking comments made by the LAPD police chief at the time, Darrell Gates. And of course, we learn a bit later on in the documentary that he refused to apologize for those comments. And he gave a sort of apology for people being offended, which is hardly an apology. Lee, what was your reactions watching those comments being made?
Well, I mean, they're horrific. And Darrell Gates, I mean, this area and this time in American history and leading up to the riots, there's been a number of films made on this in the last few years. And so this the film goes over, you know, if you're familiar with those films, a lot of familiar ground. So Darrell Gates has been vilified, very rightly so, a lot of the time. What's very interesting about this film is there's a section towards the end where they show that his son himself was addicted to drugs. And it's not letting him off the hook in any shape or form, but it's giving you another side to this person who is very easy otherwise to just demonize as, you know, the big bad guy. And don't get me wrong, his policies and his, you know, his stance is you know, you can't justify it in any way. But what's really interesting about the film is it tries to sort of look at people from different angles and maybe give facets of them you didn't know about without excusing it. But you know, you go, okay, well then this guy has some other issues going on at the time. Now again,
that
doesn't
is a
excuse
very
it,
complex
but it's
story.
it's really trying to look at things from a wider angle than you maybe have seen in the past.
And Suresh, would you agree with what Lee said just there? What did you make of these comments being made?
Life is complicated. People are very complicated. I've been in riots in Southall in the 70s, and I know people are complicated. But to justify, I'm not saying Lee is justifying, I don't want to give an air of justification. To me, the comment about the chokehold and not apologizing was sheer racism, and there's no excuse for it. He's a senior police officer. He's a senior police officer who should be held accountable for his comments and his practices and procedures. Mm-hmm. Yes, he's a human being, but we are beyond that in that environment. So when I live in areas like South, which is where I come from, which has had riots, I expect police officers to be totally professional. What I don't expect them to do is to blame the victim or the communities that are victimized by police officers because of their racism. And it's happened not just to black people. I did a case of Blair Peach, who was killed by the SPG in 1979. You know what the police said? He had a thin cranium, that's why he died. Mm. And they used a lead gauge baton to kill him in 1979. Mm. In Mark Duggan's case, what did they say? Honest but mistaken belief. Mm. So there's a justification that takes place perpetually by the mainstream and politicians. I do not want to excuse that. Yes. That doesn't mean cinematically people can't look at the complicated picture and come to a resolution. Mm. But our society is divided between people who have power and who don't have power.
That's
really important to look at.
And Lee, I want to ask you, in picking up on your point, do you think Ridley was sympathetic in any way to the riots through this film? Do you get the idea that the police are in fact the problem, that the riots or uprisings didn't happen out of a vacuum, that people just became crazy one day?
No, I mean, the whole 10-year time frame, as Suresh has noted, it gives you the context and it gives you a lot of understanding of why tensions within the communities and between the police and not just the African-American community, the Korean-American community, Japanese-American, mm-hmm. It's a very, diverse picture that this film paints. I think Ridley is very... he's an interesting figure because he's kind of known as a bit of a polemicist. Mm-hmm. He wrote a very controversial piece for a magazine about 10 years ago using the N-word and criticizing his own community, mm-hmm. With 12 Years a Slave, which he wrote
the
screenplay
for.
Yeah, him and the director had a big falling out. And I was surprised, actually, at how much empathy this shows. It's not his usual kind of... mode of speaking, if you like. He's very much into controversy usually and stirring things up, and I felt that this was a much more restrained and trying to be more empathetic to look at it. He doesn't let anybody off the hook. So as I said, you don't identify some of the people speaking, and then you find that actually some of these guys were the guys who dragged the white truck driver out of the van and nearly killed him. Mm-hmm. Similarly with the police, you see some people making some very, reasonable statements, and you find out they're absolutely part of the endemic racism of the LA police force. Mm-hmm. So I was very interested at getting that sort of, empathetic thing. And again, without letting anybody off the hook, and there is clear racism going on there without any shadow of a doubt.
Of course, and it's interesting that so many interpretations can come out of this, and I guess that's a testament to the documentary. And Lee, as we heard in the documentary, one of the police officers in charge at the time told his police officers to avoid that area. Mm. Were they effectively then abandoning their duty to protect and serve?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly no expert on police tactics and what you should and shouldn't do, but there was a very clear, decision taken to pull out, and obviously that creates a vacuum, and that allows a lot more things potentially to go on that maybe would be restricted if there was a police presence there. But I mean, this is just part of the chaos. I mean, what it does, it really gives you a picture of the absolute chaos that happened within those 2 days. I was actually in LA probably a couple of weeks after these events, and I was actually walking around through South Central LA. I'd never been in a sort of supposedly peaceful community that had such an air of foreboding and tension. And so it was still, just absolutely in the air, really, really unnerving. So I can only imagine what it would have been like on the 2 days in question. Again, that's no excuse not to get the police in there, because that effectively is their job, to try and maintain, some sort of, so that things don't just descend into utter chaos. It obviously had a huge impact on the events of those 2 days.
And Suresh, why didn't the police go to the area? Were you surprised by their reaction? Were they intimidated by the riots?
I wasn't surprised at all by the reaction. It's a very common police practice in a public disturbance to leave an area on its own. Public disturbances and riots raise a number of issues, and one of them is, why is it that law-abiding citizens living in that area destroy their town?
That they have genuine grievances.
I've been involved, as I said, I've participated in public disturbances. The trigger for me has been racists coming in and the police not stopping them, and then the police arresting us on a continuous basis. And
so the victims instead of the perpetrators.
There's a time bomb that comes. And when you are there, you realize the danger that exists. You realize the chaos that exists. You realize that you live in the area and you're breaking up a shop and that you're fighting with the police. You actually realize it's very conscious. It's not as if it's unconscious and there's God, nobody's in control. It's frightening. And it's only people who participate in it, who want to create a message, actually win the day. So you create those areas where the police can't enter for a specific period, for a specific reason. And that is to say that if we are not heard, and if after all, even according to, you know, the apostle of peace, Martin Luther King, riots are the voices of the unheard, mm-hmm. which is actually what they are. Yes, you have sterile areas created by the police. But in the same way, you have policing of what you call saturation policing, which they talk about in the earlier period, which is indiscriminate arrests at certain times mm. to create fear in community.
It was Project Hammer, I think they were called it in the documentary, Operation Project Hammer.
Yeah, I mean, in this country, they call it saturation policing. Mm. And we've, in BRICS...
Well, we'll just pause there for now, as John Ridley talking during an ABC radio interview with Amna Nawaz about the prospect of another uprising.
Worry there could be similar kinds of level of riots or uprisings and
absolutely
that, yeah.
You know, look, whether how the scope and scale, how big they are, how pervasive they are, you know, again, you know, Los Angeles is a city, how it was policed, and I don't even mean the psychology of it, just the numbers, the demographics, what the capacities were, that's very, very different. It was very, very singular. So I have no doubt in terms of interactions, in terms of what happens in communities, how we look at each other, you know, that we know. I mean, we just know that there are issues, whether that results in a large-scale uprising, whether it results in a few individuals spilling out on the streets, mm-hmm. whether that is a public demonstration where police and citizenry are going out together to say, look, there's an issue and we got to deal with it, or whether it's just people who feel like they're fed up. You know, how it happens, what the results are, that I can't predict, but I'm absolutely sure that there are stress points, that there are people who feel like they're being marginalized, they're not being listened to somewhere right now, and they are going to want recourse. We need to make sure that that recourse is positive, it's real engagement, because otherwise, you know, when you take away people's voices, when you take away their ability to be heard, they will make themselves heard in any way that they feel is appropriate.
Lee, you were just saying earlier how much of an activist Ridley is. What did you make of his comments there in that radio interview?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important. You know, historically, he's done these, you know, he's had these moments where people have been very critical of what he's done. People change. And I think he would probably say that he's not the same filmmaker or maybe even person that he was when he did these other projects. And fair play to him. You know, if we're discussing this particular film, I think it's a really balanced, restrained, empathetic portrait that really tries to get to the, you know, the hub of a wide range of issues. So, you know, I can only kind of agree with everything he's saying. And it's also, I think the other thing is, we hear so much about this one time in LA. I would love to hear similar projects about other cities in the US and also in other countries. It's not just America that has systemic, you know, issues with its police force and racism mm-hmm. stuff. It's happening all over the world. And it would be great if there were, you know, similar projects as detailed and nuanced mm-hmm. that covered other areas. I know more about, you know, Rodney King and Latasha Harlins than I do about some of the, you know, the issues that have happened in this country simply because of the proliferation of documentaries and studies about this time. Mm-hmm. It's all important, mm-hmm. but I'd also like to see other areas and other countries covered in a similar way.
That's interesting. Of course, this year marks 25 years since the LA riots. Perhaps this is why all the emergence of these documentaries are coming out. But Suresh, I'd like to ask you, actually, what are some of the differences or similarities between the US and the UK when it comes to institutional police racism and how they treat black people?
Let's look at the similarities. I think the British police has been found to be institutional racism because of the McPherson inquiry in 1999. And there hasn't been enough work done by the police to show that they've actually dealt with it properly. You've seen in this country, just like America, although the proportion of killings in America is much, much, much greater. You have something like 16 deaths a day. Mm-hmm. You don't have the same frequency, but it's a smaller black population than America. The American population has been there longer. I think what you really have in similarity is the lack of accountability of the police force. The manner in which police always, almost get away with murder or police brutality. Nobody's actually held account in a public arena.
Of course, this is why what caused the riots, effectively the straw that broke the camel's back, was that there was videotape evidence of Rodney King's brutal bleeding, the police officers walked free.
They walked free in Rodney King's case, as far as the district was concerned. But obviously, as you know, two people were convicted in the federal court, the subsequent trial. And there are important points to make on the judiciary as well in this trial.
The whole criminal justice system.
The differences are that just the black American political process of being there for a long time, of developing resistance, black power politics, is much more deep-seated than in this country. But this country has this glass ceiling which does not see pivotal figures in the black community just as important as the Americans would do in terms of black. For example, people like Huey Newton in the black power movement, there are equivalents in this country. And just like this film, there's a film called Hard Stop on Totem Riots, which is a fascinating, film of the killing of Duggan told through the eyes of his two friends. It's a fascinating film. It could be much better if it was given more finances. Mm-hmm. So there are attempts being made. But I think this country neglects and actually does not acknowledge the skills that black communities have in their communities, young people, women, and children.
So there's much work to be done, I suppose. And unfortunately, we're reaching the end of the program now. And Lee, just the final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
I would. I think, I've seen quite a number of the recent films that either touch on this specific area or, institutional racism. And I would say it's one of the more thorough and nuanced films. I would also recommend the Made in America film, which again covers similar things. But it really is, it's proper journalism, and it's also good filmmaking. And when you put those together, you really do allow viewers to get a better understanding, and then hopefully that's what you can build on to sort of, change things in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming on to Doc Review. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.